Hey, everybody. As the co-host of your Chillpack Hollywood Hour, it's always delightful to shoot the transatlantic breeze with the UK Midweek Drive team. Together, we aim to provide the best possible audio backdrop for political sanity in the 21st century. This is Phil Lairness, reporting from the middle ground between science and superstition. And you have entered the podcast zone.
Long, long time ago, I can still remember how that music used to make me smile. And I knew if I had my chance that I could make those people dance, and maybe they'd be happy for a while. But February made me shiver with every paper I'd deliver. Bad news on the doorstep, I couldn't take one more step. I can't remember if I cried when I read about his widowed bride, but something touched me deep inside the day the music died. So bye-bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. And them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing, "This'll be the day that I die. This'll be the day that I die." Did you write the book of love, and do you have faith in God above? If the Bible tells you so, do you believe in rock and roll? Can music save your mortal soul? And can you teach me how to dance real slow? Shoes. Man, I dig those rhythm and blues. I was a lonely teenage bronc and buck with a pink carnation and a pickup truck. But I knew I was out of luck the day the music died. I started singing bye bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. Day that I die, this will be the day that I die. Now for 10 years we've been on our own, and moss grows fat on a rolling stone, but that's not how it used to be. When the jester sang for the king and queen in a coat he borrowed from James Dean, and a voice that came from king was looking down, the jester stole his thorny crown, the courtroom was adjourned, no verdict was returned. And while Lennon read a book on Marx, the quartet practiced in the park, and we sang dirges in the dark. The day the music died, we were singing that I die, this will be the day that I die. Helter skelter in the summer swelter, the birds flew off with a fallout shelter, 8 miles high and falling fast. It landed foul on the grass, the players tried for a forward pass, with the jester on the sidelines in a cast. Now the halftime air was sweet perfume. while the sergeants played a marching tune. We all got up to dance. Oh! Clenched in fists of rage, no angel born in hell could break that Satan's spell. And as the flames climbed high into the night to light the sacrificial rite, I saw Satan laughing with delight. The day the music died, he was singing bye bye Miss American Pie. I met a girl who sang the blues, and I asked her for some happy news, but she just smiled and turned away. I went down to the sacred store where I'd heard the music years before, but the man there said the music wouldn't play. And in the streets the children screamed, the lovers cried and the poets dreamed, but not a word was spoken. The church bells all were broken, and the three men I admire most, the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, they caught the last train for the coast the day the music died. And they were singing bye bye Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry, and them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing this'll be the day that I die. This'll be the day that I die. They were singing bye-bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. Them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing this'll be the day that I die.
It was April 2022, specifically April 29th, 2022, when we had the headline for the Author of the Week, A Bad Deal for America and the Decline of America. And maybe, as we've just come out of American Pie, it was very much the day the politics died. The creator, of course, of this particular text, which has a fascinating conclusion, which I'll share with you in a few moments, is the wonderful Professor David Shine. David, back with us, of course, on the program. Welcome back to the Midweek Drive. David, how are you?
I'm doing great, and I'm a huge a fan of the UK, and in fact, we'll be visiting next summer and working on my travel plans now, and it is wonderful to be returning.
Excellent. Well, that's good news. Now, I did say I would actually read from the conclusion of Bad Deal for America, because I know we spoke about this at length a year or so ago. You end the text with, "Our founding fathers believed in a real democracy where the government did the bidding of the people. America is far from that today. In order to have civilian legislators that come from the people, stay connected to the people and serve the people's interests, we must have substantial reforms. Millionaires who hang out mostly in the rare air of Washington, D.C., are paid well above the average American's income and abuse their positions for years, and they're not representative of the average American." Now, obviously, it goes on a year later, and we talked about this, obviously, a year or so ago. It doesn't seem to have gotten any better. I mean, is this not a case of it's business as usual? We need to, in a sense, suck it up and deal with it. Democracy is in a rotten position because there are challenges, obviously, with respect to Britain as well as America.
Yes. Well, of course, being a news junkie, and not just for U.S. news, I'm aware of the fact that you've had the PM shuffle over there. And we in America don't understand exactly how that works. But I can tell you that in my previous book, Decline of America, I actually suggest that we probably in the United States do need to move to a more European system. And I know that's people want to wash my mouth out with soap if I say that here in the States. But I think the job of president is too big for somebody to control both international and domestic. So I also think that having a system where you can recall the president that's less involved than what we're doing with the impeachment might be a good idea here in the States. So, again, you know, it's sometimes you have that problem not invented here syndrome, but that one might be some things that we should look into. And I think the last couple presidents have kind of put the nail in the coffin for the current system. I mean, Trump was good on domestic policy. The economy did well, but he was despised around the world. And then Biden, frankly, doesn't have much to say for himself domestically or internationally as Ukraine burns on and China threatens Taiwan. So I don't think we got much of any fix in the current administration. And I am following very closely the scandals that are, I can say that despite the corruption in the U.S. Justice Department, some refer to it as the Injustice Department, I'm not sure how the current administration survives what's come out over progressively over the last several months. So it is, unfortunately, business as usual sometimes comes down to the lowest common denominator. And that appears to be what has happened now, that we really do have even a more serious crisis of leadership than perhaps we've had when I released the book just a few, just 14, 15 months ago. I mean, it's one of those things to write a book and to say things are really bad. And it's another thing for things that keep getting worse after you release the book and to say, "See, I told you so." So I'm looking like a really smart person. And I wish I could say it was because I had such a great crystal ball, but clearly we've got to fix something soon.
I mean, the text itself, you use an awful lot of quotations throughout the actual book, which come from a whole variety of exercises and things within that. And again, consummate style in terms of the research that's gone into this. But ultimately, very few people actually come across with any kind of glowing aspects whatsoever. I mean, the obvious, Lance, is in taking a quote. I mean, for instance, if we take the quote from a congressman from Pennsylvania, 14 years in D.C., Tim Murphy, "I did not see its toxicity until I was months into the relationship." Areas with respect to that, I mean, the danger with quotes is, of course, they can be taken out of context. And I'm curious in terms of, have you had any pushback from politicians who said, "I didn't mean my quote to be taken out of that sense, in that meaning. That's not what I meant to say. or is it a case of they're too busy covering their own backsides?
Well, I think that's a very fair question. And let me back up a bit. And we talked about this last year. But in order to produce the book, the first thing people always ask me, well, what's your writing process? And I think about writing all of the time. It's kind of a passion with me. And so I came up with the concept of Bad Deal for America at least 4 years ago. And began to think about, okay, it's like a big Las Vegas in DC that you've got all this gambling and all that. How could I explain that to the people out in Kansas and Oklahoma who are struggling with these things coming out of DC? And I thought, yeah, bad deal. The interesting thing for me is I'm not a gambler. And so I had to go out and buy a pack of cards, the playing cards. And then when I looked at the playing cards, I said, you know, this is pretty cool. The other thing that I'm very committed to in both the books I have in print now is to be bipartisan, is to not just beat up on one party or the other and to be a, you know, a sycophant for one side or the other, especially because I strongly feel that both political parties have failed America. I mean, you know, basically we're dealing with a bipartisan system. And it's a failure. And I do think that if we can break that system of because remember, your committees in Congress and the Senate, all of that stuff is determined by party majority. So if they have built a system to protect these two parties in power, and so it's a complicated thing to break that and to say, have a more of what looks like in Europe, where you have a consensus where multiple parties have to join together in order to accomplish things. And so I do think that that's something that could happen. One of the things that's happening in the United States right now is a movement called No Labels. And No Labels presents itself as an alternative to the Democrats and the Republicans. My concern, which is, I guess I should be happy as a conservative, is that the No Labels movement is largely kind of Democrat light. And the Democrats are absolutely beside themselves because they know if No Labels, which is now on ballots in 10 states, gets some momentum, it will do to the Democrats what has happened with third parties. Remember that the Republicans lost in 1992 and again in 1996 because of Ross Perot, a conservative third party candidate. So if this No Labels gets some traction and pulls even a modest percentage of the vote away, it's liable to very much favor whoever is the Republican candidate. And I'm not going to opine on that at the moment. But so I think that's one of the things that, again, I view it as a positive because it may help to break things loose and start us looking at a more of a multi-party system. But it also, ironically, has the strong opposition of one party versus the other, rather than saying, hey, doesn't that look more like a real democracy? In terms of writing the book, after I came up with the concept of the deck of cards, I said, well, we're going to have 26 Republicans and 26 Democrats. And in the United States, the press arbitrarily decided that Democrats would be blue and Republicans would be red, which is hilarious because the Democrats in the United States have largely gone left, which we generally think of as the communist, which historically have been called Reds, not popular term, but it is the term that was used, comes out of the Russian Revolution. I mean, there's a historic basis for the term red. So anyway, it is pretty interesting to me, but that the colors. So then we decided that the two red sweets would be the Republicans and the two normally black sweets, we compromised a little bit. We made them blue. So the blue sweets are the black cards, the clubs and the spades, and then the hearts and the diamonds were that. But that's how I came up with the concept. And I can tell you that the people in Congress complain ad nauseum about how badly paid they are. And I lived in the Washington, D.C. area. It was part of my inspiration for the first book, Decline of America. I lived in Alexandria, which is an immediate suburb of D.C. And I got to be the thing that we all joke about, the fly on the wall. I got to go to, I hung out with Bill Archer, was the chairman of Ways and Means, a very powerful position. And I had an inside track to hang out with his folks. And it gave me a special view behind the scenes without having any personal liability. I mean, it was near perfect. And I can tell you that I've seen this up close and personal. And it's a very interesting thing. But they complain about it. And what I conclude in the book that you just read from is that why don't they all go home, stay in their districts and live under the laws they've created, and maybe come to D.C. periodically. In fact, I've suggested, I've got a complete solution for this. We're going to build a dormitory, like a university dormitory. As you know, I'm also a university professor. We're building a new dormitory at my school. We build a big dormitory. We put the Republicans and the Democrats tutor a room like they do in college, and they have to get along. Maybe put a Republican and a Democrat in each room to really make them get along. And they can come to D.C. periodically. That'll be about $50 a night for them to be in the dorms, and they can get together and vote. Otherwise, they can use Zoom or Teams or something like that and talk to each other, and it's easy. And they don't have to have a house in D.C. D.C. is one of the most expensive housing markets in the United States. The people tend to overlook it because we talk about L.A. and San Francisco and New York, but D.C. is certainly in the stratosphere. And the people in Congress live in the expensive subdivisions in many cases. They're not living in the cheap seats like I did when I lived there. I lived in I found a little corner of the world that had been overlooked by the developers. And I was able to get into the area, but I can tell you that it's pretty crazy. But to get better connected. Now, in terms of quotations, you hit on what we did. Obviously, I didn't pick the people that are quite intelligent. And some of the people in the book, let's be fair, are quite smart. But they forget that if you're a member of the Congress or a member of the Senate, you are one of a unique group of about 500 people out of a population of 340 million, roughly. You are automatically, by being elected to the Congress or the Senate, you're important, and you ought to be paying attention to what the heck that you say every blessed moment that you're not singing in your shower. It's like that. So we deliberately looked for people who said ludicrous things. And I do want to be fair and say there are people quoted in that book who I support politically. But we caught them saying dumb stuff, and we felt, it's intended to have a bit of humor to it. And so there was a purpose behind what we selected. But many of the people I consider babbling losers that should never have been elected. And I'm offended that those people are in Congress on the American dole. And so that was part of the book. We wanted to say, look, you voted for this person. These are some of the stupid, racist, sexist, awful things that some of these people have said. And I will tell you that in our research, we found Congressman Bob Dorman, who's the late congressman. He was from California. He said some things that we did not put in the book because they were so offensive that we felt that it would get the book blacklisted. I mean, this is a member of the United States Congress, and this was 20 or 25 years ago that he said some things that were that outrageous that I had to sit there and say, gosh, I really don't think I want to put this in the book, but that's what we're talking about.
David, you've raised a number of key points, one of which is obviously making use of technology, as we're doing for this interview, which yes. has a relatively low carbon footprint because you haven't had to fly over to Britain and I haven't had to fly over to the USA either. So it's good from that point of view. However, there is an elephant, not a Democrat, but an elephant in the room. And I would say that is the ongoing challenge that we have had globally with respect to ChatGPT and the artificial intelligence and the area with respect to that. And of course, the notion that fake news or artificially created quotes can be developed, enhanced, and so on. Understandably, that's creating an awful lot of confusion with the general population. And just as there are many people within Britain who have realized that actually voting to separate from the European Union and voting for Brexit hasn't turned out as they'd hoped it would, because yeah. partly of a number of reasons, which we is another book, basically, we have to go into. And that's a side of things. Is that something which you're concerned about? Because we are entering a period of, in a sense, human experience, which when we look back at characters such as Richard Nixon, we look back at the founder of the original New Deal, Roosevelt, and the whole aspect of ways in which they were put forward. And there were, you know, America's had an awful lot of fallible human beings in the position of commander-in-chief. I mean, I think it's yeah. fair to say there have been some good ones, but there have been others, including the chap who took it, I mean, Johnson after Lincoln, was arguably questionable. So historically, you know, there are issues with respect to that. The game changer is, of course, the technology and how that can be used to manipulate people's ideas, people's concepts, and so on. Is that something that you're concerned about, or do you feel as though human beings will find a way?
Well, first of all, I let me approach it from a couple different directions. As a professor, I do want my students to write their own papers. So I have a very practical day to day. I start teaching my semester. My fall semester starts Monday, so very immediate. And I'm concerned about that, because we've already dumbed down the population. We have not focused enough on the three R's: reading, writing, and arithmetic. Pardon the R's, of course. And we are getting students in college who are below the level of students that I went to high school with two generations earlier. So my concern with ChatGPT is that it may be used as a proxy for doing things that we need people to know how to do in order to advance our society, to become a great scientist, to cure cancer, things like that, to control space better, to have a better control of our climate. I mean, there's all sorts of important things we need to do that require the unique inventiveness of the human mind. And if you use ChatGPT let's just say AI more generically, to enhance human thinking, that's good. I had a personal experience last night. I have not subscribed to any AI service, but I admittedly do use the Microsoft suite, the Office suite, and I use Word. So I was writing my next book last night, and the darn thing, I haven't figured out how to turn it off. I'm not very tech savvy. Keeps telling me what my next word is, and I'll be like, no, that's not the word. Wait a minute, let me write my own thing. So we're seeing it. And as far as I can tell, that is an AI application, that Word, that the Microsoft people have just dropped in on Word. I'm on Windows 11 and I'm on the current version of Microsoft Office. And it's actually irritating for a professional writer like myself, because I know creatively what I want to say. And the current book, by the way, is fiction based on fact, and it's a 50-year-old story. And it's interesting because we just had Woodstock. I don't know if you picked up in England, but the anniversary of Woodstock was the fourth day was yesterday, which caused a political controversy, because the great Jimi Hendrix, who was American, but he died in London. And he was actually more popular, I think, in England than he was in the United States during his heyday. He did the national anthem to end Woodstock. And it was controversial because it was very creative. It was, in my opinion, as a rock and roller from that period, it was creative and done. And I'm a hardcore patriot. I thought that it was a tribute to America that we have, because we've had all sorts of people sing. I think maybe Roseanne Barr sang the national anthem once at a baseball game, and it caused huge controversy because she sang it so badly. But you know what? At least people stood and said, "Hey, it's the national anthem." And of course, you all have your parallel, "God Save the Queen," and which will be, I guess, the king at the moment. Is that how that works? You change the song? Okay.
Absolutely, yeah.
I'm just making sure I'm politically correct before I get
Course.
to UK next summer. It's interesting that the way it interfaces with me right now, I'd prefer that it just behave itself and not do that. You want to do the spell checker? I'm real fine with spell checkers. I actually spell pretty well, but I'm still glad to have the help, but it's a little bit over. I think that smart people or high-profile people like Elon Musk, some key politicians have said, "Guys, you better get control of this." I don't know how that works. I don't know how you get the genie back in the bottle. And I'm old enough to remember when 2001, A Space Odyssey was in the theaters. I'm trying to remember if I saw it in the theaters or not, but I think I did. And we all were captivated by the concept that a computer would take over and take out the people and say, "Hey,
And
I'm
have a
Hal,
nervous
I'm in charge.
breakdown.
Yeah, I'm in charge." And so I think that we do need to make sure that we do not have a Hal moment. At the same time, speaking of writing, and it's interesting, the particular topic I was writing on is the new Cold War, that we are in the Cold War, and those of us who remember Cold War, I just developed a white paper. The first half of it is what was the Cold War? Because if you think about it, the Cold War ended in 91, which means that if you were, say, 10 or younger in 1991 or born since then, you really don't know what the heck the Cold War was. You think it's a joke that people hid under their desks in the bomb drills and stuff like that. So, but in writing that, because it is something edgy, it was interesting that the word assist, this AI that they've imposed on it, was rather quiet. It's a lot more interactive when I'm writing fiction than when I'm writing about what's happening around the world. So I thought it was interesting that it's programmed to do certain things. So half the article is based on educating people about what happened in the Cold War. Because you can't win the current Cold War if you do not know how you won the first Cold War. And countries like Britain and the United States working together helped to create an environment that we clearly won, but I wish we'd won better and smarter.
And I guess you could also say that certainly at the time, President Ronald Reagan was not necessarily regarded internationally as being the sharpest cookie in the book. But in comparison to recent incumbents, I think he comes across as a Mensa graduate. But that's another
Yes.
line. I mean, again, an actor president who clearly worked closely with Margaret Thatcher, obviously the appropriate nature of events, the Chernobyl issue, the Glasnost perestroika incarnations of Mikhail Gorbachev and so on, clearly opened up a whole range of other aspects. Now, clearly we cope with that, and there are some people who actually say that those periods from the 1980s still resonate. Here we are in the 2020s. Although we do seem to have, with global pandemics, with obviously the artificial intelligence, with Elon Musk, of course, and who you mentioned, switching Twitter to X, which again
Oh,
seems
God.
bizarre, but again is another
I
way
agree.
of social media becoming anything but social and becoming, if anything, antisocial. Plus a whole plethora, it would seem, certainly from the academic perspective, of issues that, frankly, as an academic within Lincoln, one finds quite shocking relating to cancel culture, no platforming, issues and ideologies bubbling through in all sorts of ways. And what I mean, I'm not saying we should despair, because never despair, but would you say that in terms of optimism for our young people who are coming through, who will be faced with coping with the challenges, whatever your perception on climate change, on ideologies, and so on, is that something which you find with your students that they're keen to engage with? Or is it a case of actually we've lost something, as one of our other regular correspondents from Los Angeles, the actor Armin Shimerman, said, when we stopped teaching rhetoric, we kind of effectively stopped teaching critical minds to effectively be critical. Actually, we've lost something in terms of that basic fundamental, you say reading, writing, or arithmetic. I'd say reading, writing, and rhetoric as well from that point of view, as well as the numeracy skills.
Well, I can tell you as a grandparent that my number one concern in coaching my children and my grandchildren is reading. Reading, reading, reading. Because if you start at a young age and you're an accomplished reader and you're an inventive reader, you think about what you're reading, everything else comes with it. So I agree, rhetoric is extremely important. And again, I'm concerned because AI, at least on my Word program, interferes somewhat with what I'm trying to write, but I'm fast enough to get past that. It also gave up at some point last night, by the way, such as stopped suggesting things. So maybe it has a learning curve. But yeah, we have got to emphasize creative interest. And one of the concerns that I have is, again, don't paint all conservatives with the same brush, because I read the James, speaking of Britain, I read the James Bond novels when I was only 13 years old. And I think that would probably not happen today because, oh my God, he'd be exposed to James Bond having sex with various women around the world, including Russian spies. Oh my goodness.
Let's not get started on Live and Let Die and how that would have to be completely revamped and reworked for the whole process.
Well, and of course, as you know, we are now confronted with a woke Snow White. They've redone the cartoon, which was one of the most successful cartoons or animated movies in the history of the world, and helped to create Walt Disney, who created Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse. Is we've got to preserve something about understanding. Many Shakespeare's plays, if you read them and you understand the use of the words. I know the Shakespeare I read had the translation in today's English on the left and his original words on the right, so that you would be in the mind. But I would think that many of the Shakespeare's books, certainly Mark Twain, Huckleberry Finn, Tom Sawyer, we have got to get control of the situation. So again, I think that we need to allow people to develop as thinkers, and we need to encourage that original thought. And actually, in terms of talking about winning the Cold War, the new Cold War, called Cold War II, is to be more aggressive about thinking through things and about developing good relationships around the world. And unfortunately, I've had some previews of my draft, just so you know, including a retired colonel who felt that I was a little hawkish in my approach to things. But I'm not a wallflower. I think that we need to make sure, and that includes your children and grandchildren, and my children and grandchildren need to understand the threats and the values and the combination of things that we face today. I think we can do it. I'm an optimism, and I had some criticism about the title of my first book, Decline of America, 100 Years of Leadership Failures. And people said, Dr. Shine, we don't want to give this book to our middle school children because it's a depressing book. And I said, read the book. It's an optimistic book. It says, despite the horrendous leadership that we've had, we've won two Cold Wars. We've won two hot wars. We've won the Cold War. And we've got people on the moon, and we've invented computers, and we do all sorts of cool stuff, and we've cured all sorts of diseases. The life term of man has expanded. I'm an optimist, but I think we need to get our act together and be better leaders. And that's the point of both of my books.
Hypothetically, by the time you return to Britain, and we welcome you from that perspective, we may well have a scenario whereby a an ex-president who's in jail could be standing for election, could be the designated partner, put page to Ron DeSantis or any other challenger, and could be in that scenario. Now, that it's difficult because I also have to cite that apart from Mr. Johnson, I have respect for all of our incumbents as prime minister. To a certain extent, I feel the same about the American presidency. Apart from Mr. Trump, I have respect for all of the incumbents in all sorts of ways, even to a certain extent, Joe Biden. Is that a case of no matter how fictional, how creative one might be as an author, life has a way of kind of throwing us a bizarre curveball and we're left with a WTF moment, a what the flip happened?
Yes, WTF. Well, I am not a Trump fan. We again are locked in this two-party system where people were forced to vote on the lesser of two evils, and I think that's been true for quite a while. And I think if we humanize the political system, and the main pitch and bad deal for America, of course, is term limits, and people say, well, you're taking a democratic option away, that you're taking people away from being voted. If they're really great, why can't we vote for them for 16 consecutive terms? And to which I say, you have Feinstein, who is clearly not with it. And on the other side of the aisle, Mitch McConnell is clearly not with it. I do get concerned as a middle-aged American that we keep using the term age, 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 age. There are many, many fine people around the world who are 95 and 98. I had a friend of mine who passed. She was a world-famous violinist in her prime, and I was at her deathbed. She passed away at about age 95, and she was sharp up to the day before she died. And we need to focus on the skills and abilities that people have and not on their chronological age. And, you know, Joe Biden was never a very smart guy. So, I mean, to say, oh, my God, he's gotten too old. It's like, no.
Is he sleepy Joe? Is he creepy Joe? You don't have to answer that question.
He's both. It's that simple answer, both. But we can certainly do a lot better. And the reason I push term limits is because if we had some turn in the system, and people say, well, why can't people get voted out? Now, it is true that incumbents do lose elections, and that does happen periodically. And I know particular two U.S. congressmen who were incumbents who lost elections in the last 8 or 9 years. So it can happen, but usually it happens because the population growth in that particular district changed. And either the more conservatives moved in or more liberals moved in, somehow the population changed underneath the politician. The politician was out of sync with their district. But in general, I think it would be great to have more people involved in the system. And I don't care what their viewpoint is. I think the diversity of viewpoints in itself is a very positive thing.
David, it's been fascinating sharing some thoughts with your good self, and a reminder that the book Bad Deal for America is available on all platforms, well worth purchasing. You can get it in various budget editions as well from that point of view. Again, the combination between cards and the quotes of that, it'll have a number of laugh out loud moments as well from that perspective. But it's brought us neatly round to the time where we have to put those last two questions to you, at least for this particular sequence. Dr. David Shine,
yes,
tenured
sir.
Professor and Cameron Endowed Chair of Management and Marketing at the University of St. Thomas Cameron School of Business. Huge thanks for today. Have you had a reasonably interesting and useful Zoomer with us on the program? Has it been good for you?
It's been a blast. It's been at least as much fun as last time. And thank you for inviting me again.
Well, that brings us around to the next little question. Before we actually, we'll probably squeeze in some Jimi Hendrix just for your good self, David, after a little touch of the politics of dancing. Will you be kind enough to return? Will you come back sometime and share with us your thoughts from across the pond about the way in which our political situations in the Western world, at least, are continuing to evolve?
I'd be very happy to do that. Thank you so much.
Stop.
Well, it's here, or indeed has just passed, or indeed who knows where we're going with respect to A-level results. And indeed, is that the end of everything if you haven't got the results that you needed? And should you in fact go to university? Well, you have mentioned, or you may have acknowledged the fact that the very notion that we've said indeed several times brings us around to our guest today to actually talk about the importance of A-level results, and indeed what to do if they are changed in all sorts of ways, because we're delighted to welcome the careers expert at Indeed UK. That would be Lewis Dean, and I think I'll actually have to ease off from saying the I word for the rest of this particular piece. Lewis, how are you?
Indeed, you will, Alex. Yes, I'm very well, thank you.
It is clearly a rite of passage in so many ways. We've talked to colleagues in other countries about how they're amazed at how this pressure point, really at the height of summer in many ways, that focuses on our young people, etc., causes so many challenges and so on. But really, the whole purpose of this is to point out that actually, maybe university might be for some people, but it may well not be for all people. And there are lots of opportunities that you can use to develop your own career pathway if you haven't got the results that you perhaps were hoping for.
Absolutely, and our research bears that out, Alex. When we spoke to students a couple of weeks ago for a survey, 75% of them, so three quarters, said that their belief is you can only secure a good job if you go to university. So I think there is this kind of deep-rooted belief amongst young people that actually good careers, good jobs are only attainable if you secure a degree. But the flip side to that is that actually we also see in our research and the data from Indeed that more and more young people are exploring other options into work and not just through university. So, for example, in the last 3 years, searches for apprenticeships have increased by more than a third. And when we look at the types of jobs that young people are looking at, they are disproportionately more likely than other age groups to look at marketing roles and quite creative roles, actually. So I think my message to young people today, especially those who perhaps don't achieve the results that they were hoping for, is to not is to take a deep breath, first of all, and to remember that yes, university is important for many jobs and for many careers. However, not all roads lead to university, and there are other routes into great opportunities.
We seem to have a wonderful paradox whereby there's a challenge on the one hand with respect to university places or opportunities within that, but also you have huge areas such as the healthcare sector, the construction sector, the education sector. We were speaking recently to accountancy in terms of how even in that field there are lots of opportunities that are actually there. Is it a case of people need to have wider horizons, be prepared to effectively not necessarily be so totally focused on just the one size fits all policy, because there are lots of areas that can be explored to great effect.
Absolutely, Alex. I think that's a really good piece of advice. Now, there will be people who are set on particular jobs and particular careers. However, I think it's incredibly important that regardless if you're going to university or not, is to look at the skills that you currently possess or you may be in possession of in the upcoming months, years, because employers are really focusing on the skills, attitudes and interests of applicants and not just university degrees. So we're seeing signs on the platform of flexibility on the side of the employer, and I think that's really good news to young people and to students, especially those who may have picked up part-time work while they are at school or are thinking of entering the world of work now.
Can you cast your mind back, Lewis, hopefully not too many years ago, to when you had your own A-level results day, and whether it was received with joy, happiness, or wonderment, or was that a case of, well, I don't know, there are always opportunities elsewhere?
Alex, I'll be honest, I got what I deserved. And I was lucky in that there were options to me. I was able to go to university to study the course that I wanted to. But I think if we kind of fast forward to today, and back then when I graduated, that was in 2010, many, many years ago, we weren't going through the same cost of living issues that we are now. And the same survey that we did a couple of weeks ago showed to us that students are really reconsidering universities and courses based on cost of living pressures. So I think that's really one thing that we do need to consider as well.
It's also perhaps worth noting that, as I frequently clocked year in, year out at the University of Lincoln, that some of our better students are the ones who don't immediately jump into university after sixth form or wherever they happen to have come from. That actually, if they've had some experience of the working world and have maybe even taken a year out and so on, they come to us much better students, more well-rounded students. So perhaps that notion that university might not be appropriate at this time for potential applicants, it doesn't necessarily rule it out in future.
Absolutely. Like, and many people decide to go traveling, Alex. That's probably one of my personal regrets, is that I didn't do that when I was a bit younger. I think people can take, many routes in that gap year travel. They could pick up part-time work, they could work up full-time work. If they're able to afford it, they could maybe volunteer, they could take up paid internships. Now, the word paid is very important there. My advice is to always make sure that internships are paid. So yes, I think there's lots of productive ways of spending that year if you do decide to defer, or year or 2 years potentially.
I did say I wasn't going to mention the I word, but I think one has to, basically, as you are careers expert at Indeed UK. Lewis, where can people actually go to find out further details about just some of the things we've discussed today?
If people can head to Indeed, we have a career guide which really informs people, either making the first step or the next step in their careers, what information they need to know in order to secure better work.
Lewis Dean, careers expert at Indeed UK. Huge thanks, and keep on keeping on.
Thank you, Alex.